Do you remember that store in the mall when we were kids that sold mini bonsai trees and like meditative water features, and it was the most calming Zen place ever? Well, I was pretty obsessed with those as a kid, and I was so taken by these tiny trees potted in the most adorable planters, and I was very just taken with the miniaturization of these beautiful nature scenes. I would frequently bring those puppies home and kill them because I didn't understand how to care for them, but I am put at ease to hear that I am not the only one who struggled with bonsai care after speaking to many of you guys about bonsai on Instagram and our guest today. We are so lucky to be joined for a Bonsai 101 interview with Bjorn from Aesan Bonsai on YouTube. It is an unbelievable YouTube channel with amazing videos. We cover so much about this niche hobby of bonsai within an already niche hobby of plant care. So let's get right to it. Welcome to episode 119 of Bloom and Grow Radio. Hello, my plant friends. I hope you've had wonderfully planty weeks. Oh my gosh, it is warming up. We are so ready for spring here. We moved to our cabin December 30th in the middle of winter under 2 feet of snow in the middle of a pandemic. So we really haven't been able to dive into the community aspect here. I've made some fun plant friends at plant shops and through Facebook groups, but I'm really ready to just dive in and like make real friends in our new home. And spring is going to be a big part of that. So we're very excited. I want to dive right into this episode. But before we dive in, I wanted to say thank you so much. We have had an influx of Patreon supporters. Thank you to our newest plant friends, Laura, Stephanie, Wendy, Rosemary, and Molly. You guys are amazing. The Patreon plant friends are listeners across the world who support Bloom and Grow Radio monetarily on a monthly basis. And in the next few weeks, we're going to be launching 2 new levels of Patreon, and they're amazing plant friends. You're going to die when I get to officially announce them. But the current Patreon supporters are going to get first dibs. So if you're interested in becoming a plant friend, you can check the links below. So plant friends, I've wanted to do a bonsai episode forever. I've been fascinated by bonsai for a long time. We've had many listeners write in requesting this episode. We are so lucky that Bjorn gave us his time. He's so freaking knowledgeable. And I could feel like I could have him back for a 102, 103, 104 episode as well, because I feel like we barely scratched the surface. But I hope that this is as enlightening and fun of a conversation for you as it was for me. So without further ado, here's Bjorn.
Bjorn, welcome to the Bloom and Grow Radio podcast.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
I haven't felt like this much of a novice with approaching an interview in a really long time. So thank you for giving me those novice butterflies. And I can't wait to learn so much from you today about bonsai.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive into sort of more beginner-oriented material as well.
Yeah, I feel so honored that you're joining me to educate everyone, because your platform is so next level geared for almost bonsai experts. Like every video you tune into, I almost feel like it's assumed that someone kind of already knows bonsai. So it's so nice that you're coming down to my level, down to our level to talk. So before we dive into, you know, all things bonsai, I would love to know all things Bjorn. How did you become the bonsai expert that you are today?
Sure. Yeah. So I originally was introduced to bonsai when I was 12 years old. I saw the Karate Kid movies, thought that the trees looked pretty cool in that. So I asked my parents for a bonsai for my 13th birthday. So they went to the local Home Depot and bought me one of those Japanese garden junipers that had the rocks glued on the top with the little Mr. Miyagi Mudman underneath the tree. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was dead when I got it, but I put it on my nightstand at the end of my bed. And within probably 2 to 3 weeks, it was completely brown. But by that point, I was absolutely totally hooked. So I turned it into a real passion during my high school years, founded the Knoxville Bonsai Society with my dad, actually. Wow. And then when I moved to university, I went to the University of Tennessee to study Japanese language and business. I decided during that period, when I graduated, I wanted to pursue bonsai professionally. So I ended up moving to Japan when I was 22 and doing an apprenticeship.
Wow. And how long were you over in Japan for?
So all total, it was 9 years. A typical apprenticeship in Japan for bonsai is 5 years. And then you give an extra year as a gift or a thank you to your teacher for having taken you on for so long. So I stayed 6 years as an apprentice total, and then an additional 3 years as artist in residence at that same nursery.
Oh my goodness. So there are bonsai nurseries that only do bonsai trees, and you're just all day, every day pruning, doing maintenance. I'm assuming we're going to get into what that looks like, but you were just living and breathing bonsai for that long.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you do an apprenticeship in Japan like that, it's 7 days a week, 365 days a year. If you're lucky, you get maybe one day off a month. During the busy season, which is typically October through March, you're really not getting any time off, maybe one day every other month, for example. But it's sun up till sundown. You have to be passionate about it and love it to be able to stick with it through the end of the full apprenticeship.
That's next level plant parent passion. Holy moly. So you mentioned you studied Japanese business and language in college. Do you think that the bonsai is kind of what got you into Japanese culture? Where did that connection start?
Yeah, actually, so I got into Japanese culture prior to finding out about bonsai. I started doing karate when I was 8 years old.
Okay, cool.
In an after school program at elementary school and got interested in architecture. I was big into like designing houses and things like that and drawing when I was younger. So my grandfather back then bought me a Japanese architecture photo book. So I got really into that aspect of Japanese design. So bonsai just kind of came along with that. It was a very natural transition to get into bonsai.
Were you the only guy from Nashville at the bonsai nursery in Japan? Were there many Americans over there?
No, there had been a few foreign apprentices, not at the nursery where I was studying, but at other nurseries in Japan prior to me going, but only, I would say, less than a handful in the history of bonsai in Japan, which is, you know, hundreds of years old, obviously.
Oh my gosh. Talk about immersion.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Amazing. It was definitely an interesting experience. So the language was probably the biggest issue for me when I started the program. I'd gotten my degree in Japanese language at university, but you only learn how to really read and write. You don't really learn how to speak properly. So for the first few months there, that was probably the biggest issue with my teacher. And by the way, you call your teacher oyakata in Japanese, which translates to parental figure. So your teacher is more like an extended part of your family. They're very harsh on you and they expect you to work very hard. But if you get sick, for example, they're there to take care of you. And they're there to guide you through the whole process of an apprenticeship. So it's an interesting kind of relationship that you develop with your teacher.
That's so beautiful. And now you've kind of re-embodied what that looks like to all of your digital students in a very different way. But how cool that you're honoring your teacher, you know, what your teacher has taught you and amplifying it across so many digital students across the world, I assume.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we have right now, I think like 145,000 followers on YouTube. So it's grown tremendously over the last year. I mean, for such a niche market, that's actually, I'm pretty proud of what we've been able to build on YouTube the last year. We started out 2020 with, I think, 70,000 subscribers. So we more than doubled.
Wow. In a year, which congratulations.
Was great. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, you can tell the quality of your videos are amazing. I've been binging them all week. And this is a few followers of mine on Instagram have said this, that your videos are just so soothing to watch. Like, normally I put a YouTube video up while I make my lunch or do something like that. But I was like, no, I need to just sit and watch these videos. It's so satisfying to watch you, especially your time-lapse videos, to just watch like this like raw tree get turned into this like stylized bonsai. It's amazing. I don't know anything about bonsai. So what I would love to do is start is understanding, what is a bonsai? What makes a tree a bonsai tree?
Sure. Yeah. So first off, let's start with the pronunciation of the word. So it's actually bonsai rather than bonsai. I mean, that's a common misunderstanding in the West. Okay. Bonsai in Japanese translates to long live the emperor. So it was a shout that was given like a sort of praise during the war, World War II, for example, long live the emperor, basically. But bonsai, it's a different character or two different characters rather. So bonsai, when you put it together, it essentially means to plant in a container or a potted plant. But, you know, as you know, it's much more than just a potted plant. We don't call just your average potted plants on your front porch a bonsai. So bonsai typically have a single front from which they should be viewed. And the idea is to find a plant, typically a woody plant, find the best, most interesting characteristics within that plant, whether that be movement in the trunk or deadwood, perhaps, or an interesting line in the branches of the tree, and then show that off from one particular view. So our goal is to find that front, find the best angle, prune the tree up, perhaps wire the tree to create a picture frame around those interesting characteristics and create essentially a work of living art.
Okay, bonsai. So on this podcast, I have a horrific history of mispronouncing plant Latin. So I'm so happy to hear that my mispronunciation translates not just to plant Latin, but to Japanese as well. Okay. So can any tree be a bonsai? Is bonsai the act of manicuring a tree and having it be viewed from that front, can I bonsai a rosemary plant because it's woody? Or is there a certain type of tree that gets qualified as that?
Really, any species can become a bonsai, but there are certain characteristics that we're looking for in the plants that we choose to turn into bonsai that make a particular species more usable as bonsai art. So for example, you wouldn't necessarily want to use something that has very, very large leaves. The idea is that we're trying to create essentially a large tree shrunk down into miniature form. So if you're using a tree with very large leaves, it looks quite out of proportion with the overall size of the plant. So that would be one of the main things that we're actually searching for, whether we're working with conifers or broadleaf evergreen or deciduous species, would be small leaves. Second thing would be, obviously, we need to really work with woody plants. So plants that actually produce bark on them, for example. So pretty much all of your conifers are going to be great for this. I wouldn't necessarily recommend using something like a succulent as a bonsai. I don't think that translates very well into bonsai art, but really any tree that's woody that has small leaves can potentially become a bonsai.
And it should be a tree. It shouldn't be just like a tropical foliage plant or something.
It can be a bush as well. When I do my lessons online, like on YouTube, for example, or on our online learning platform, Bonsai U, I talk a lot about apical dominance versus lateral dominance in our plants. So apical dominance would be with plants that are considered to be trees. So the apex of the tree is the strongest part of the plant relative to the lower branches. With bushes and shrubs, for example, most of those are laterally dominant. So the lower branches are going to be stronger than the apex. This is why they stay relatively small and grow outward rather than upward. So either one of those groups can be used as bonsai, but there are implications for how we prune those different groups to maintain the apex or maybe keep the apex a little bit smaller and keep the lower branches healthier and alive.
Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today.
Okay, so you have to understand what type of tree it is and what type of dominance it has, because that's going to affect how you prune it and how you maintain it.
Exactly. Like, for example, if you want to turn like an azalea into a bonsai, azaleas tend to be laterally dominant. So the lower branches tend to be much stronger than the apex. So if you want to keep the apex alive and very healthy, we're actually going to prune the lower branches more frequently and prune them back more, remove more foliage than we would with the apex. This is going to help balance the energy between those different portions of the plant and keep the entire tree alive for a longer period of time.
So I've heard you say this in two different ways now. So is bonsai a verb or a noun?
Bonsai technically is a noun.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I
although
would
you could say
bonsai.
To bonsai something, in English, it's become much more of a verb, I guess, or it can be used as a verb. Yeah, exactly. In Japanese, it is just a noun.
Okay. To make it a bonsai.
Yes.
Through pruning and styling.
Exactly. And applying wire, like an aluminum wire or copper wire, or just doing clip and grow. So thinking about the directionality of a bud, cutting back to that bud to grow a branch to the left, for example, or to the right, if you want a branch to move in the opposite direction. So you can do clip and grow as well without having to apply wire.
Okay. So I'm thinking about when I used to go to the mall and there was like a bonsai store. And it had like all sorts of little water features and all sorts of bonsais, and they're all really small. So are the majority of bonsais also super small trees? And are those larger trees that you're pruning back to be small? Or are there a lot of dwarf varieties that end up being used a lot in bonsai?
Sure. Yeah. So within bonsai, there are some basic size categories that we typically talk about.
P.S. Do you know the mall? Do you know the store at the mall that I'm talking about?
I have seen stores like that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. So within bonsai, there are some size categories that we talk about. And there are a lot of words in Japanese that we've actually adopted into sort of the English lexicon when it comes to bonsai. So I'll go over some of those with you here. So starting with the smallest trees, we call them shohin bonsai, which just translates to basically small product, but a very small bonsai. So these would be bonsai that are less than 8 inches tall, measured from the top of the pot to the apex of the tree. So we don't worry about the actual size of the pot. We're just talking about the physical size of the tree itself.
The tree.
Yeah. So these would be trees under 8 inches tall. These are very difficult to produce and maintain because, again, most of the species that we work with are going to grow outward and upward. So a lot of the shohin trees are actually made out of dwarf cultivars of conifers and broadleaf species as well. The next category would be something called chuhin, which is medium-sized trees. So these would be plants that are between about 8.5 inches to basically about 17 or 18 inches tall, somewhere in that range. And then there are large bonsai called ogata bonsai in Japanese. And these would be trees that are larger than that 18-inch mark. And these could be trees that are up to 4, 5, 6 feet tall. There really isn't necessarily a limit on the size of a tree that can become a bonsai. But as a general rule of thumb, most bonsai are less than about 4 feet tall max, typically. It also somewhat depends on the country that you're dealing with. Like India, for example, they have bonsai that are maybe 6, 7, 8 feet tall. Vietnam would be the same as well, China too. But typically, if you're talking about Japanese bonsai or bonsai in the United States, under 4 feet, essentially the limit.
So does each country have its own bonsai culture, or where does bonsai originate from?
There's a little bit of back and forth in terms of where bonsai actually started. So most people, and if you look at history, it seems most likely that bonsai came from China originally. The characters are essentially the same. It's pensai in Chinese. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. My wife's actually from China. She makes fun of my Chinese pronunciation all the time. But it's essentially the same characters as bonsai, but it's pronounced pensai in Chinese. So essentially, there's some pictorial evidence that suggests that that started in China sometime around probably the year 500, 600. So it's quite old. But there are some people in India who claim that planted pots started in India as Ayurvedic medicine, and then that moved to China, and then it was turned into an art form, and then that art form moved to Japan. So there's a little bit of discrepancy there as to exactly where it originated. But that's typically kind of the route that most people think that it took.
So this podcast, which is mostly about houseplants, I guess we have those potted plants in India to thank to have started the whole trend.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's so interesting. So basic bonsai care. Bonsai care. So I'm a total knucklehead and totally acknowledging how little I know. But to me, bonsai has always been those like miniature trees that I've bought at the store. I used to be obsessed with them in my early teens as well. But I've always had them indoors, not that I ever really knew how to care for them. I very much relate to the story that you told. So your bonsai are all outdoors. So are there differences between indoor and outdoor bonsai that we should know about, especially because I would assume that most people listening to this show might want to get one for inside?
Yes. So you definitely need to make sure that whatever species that you're purchasing to turn into a bonsai or that has already been turned into the bonsai that you're buying, you need to figure out if it's, say, a subtropical or tropical tree or a temperate climate tree. So all of the plants that I deal with here at my nursery are all temperate climate trees. So they have to have 4 seasons. They need to be outdoors for the most part. Sometimes we'll bring them indoors for 2 to 4 days at a time just to display them. But 99% of the time, they need to be outside. If you want to grow indoor bonsai, I would recommend looking into things like ficus, for example. Ficus benjamina is a great one, or Ficus retusa would be another great one to turn into a bonsai. Sarissa is another really common indoor bonsai. They produce really beautiful little white flowers, although they can be somewhat of a finicky species to work with. Another one would be pomegranate. for example. Now, pomegranate, there's a little bit of back and forth. There are some cultivars of pomegranate that do well in very cold temperatures below freezing. We have a few examples of those here, but there are some other pomegranates that will survive really well indoors as well.
Got it. I'm thinking of like potbelly figs, which I'm pretty sure are ficus. Would those be considered bonsai as well?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with potbelly figs. That's a cute name, though. I never heard of that before.
It's a very cute name. They usually look like other bonsai at the store, that they're in like a tiny container. They have these kind of exposed potbelly roots, and then their foliage is very small. They have like tiny leaves, and you can kind of clip it. I'll send you a picture and I can clarify it in the outro.
Sure.
Very interesting. And I would assume if we're keeping them indoors, if they're trees that mostly require four seasons, I'm going to guess that they probably also require really high light. Like, I'm going to assume that there's no low light bonsai.
Typically, no.
Okay.
You know, although there are some species, when you do maintain them indoors, some tropical trees like Scheffelera, for example, that don't necessarily require a lot of light. But the problem with Scheffelera is if you put them in low light, the leaves are naturally going to get larger. If you keep them in more sunlight, like next to a window, for example, or if you live in a temperate climate and it gets cold in the winter, you bring them in during the winter, but during the summer months, you put them outside, the leaves are going to stay relatively small. So you can still produce an image of a larger tree with those small leaves. It would be much more in balance.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Got it. So let's talk about basic bonsai care. I guess first, I think what everyone thinks about is what's going on under the soil. And this was something I thought about a lot as when I was watching your videos. You have these big trees, which I think would probably fall into the chuhin or the larger categories, but they're in tiny pots. So how does that work?
Yeah. So we'll start out with the soil, for example. So when you're dealing with like houseplants, for example, you can use potting mix that you can find at any Home Depot or Lowe's or any garden center. With bonsai, our goal is total control over the growth of the plant. So we actually use almost entirely inorganic components when we mix our soil together. So there are three basic components that I would recommend that most people try to get their hands on when creating soil for bonsai. The first would be pumice. Pumice holds a lot of moisture, but it will also release that moisture back to the plants relatively easily. Lava rock would also be another good component. It's really good for aeration and drainage. And then the third component is actually a type of soil imported from Japan called Akadama, spelled A-K-A-D-A-M-A. And it basically translates to red balls or red clay balls. So it's essentially high-fired clay. It does have some cation exchange capacity. So it is technically partially organic, but because it's so high-fired, it loses a lot of that organic matter within it. So the function of Akadama is to hold moisture and also to retain fertilizer and then release that back to the tree. So by keeping the plants in essentially an inert soil mix, we can then decide how much fertilizer we give to the tree and the type of growth that we're going to get out of the plant. So we can control how fast they grow, how slow they grow, how fast the branches thicken, how much ramification, meaning how much branching can you produce on the tree in a single growing season by controlling the soil and then the fertilization as well.
It sounds like you're totally in control of fertilizer, which is super interesting. So do you fertilize every time you water?
Typically not, or at least we don't put like a dispersion system in the end of the hose, for example, that puts out kind of micro doses of fertilizer to the trees. Typically what we do is actually apply either synthetic or organic fertilizer to the soil and let that over time naturally leach into the soil. So technically, I guess you could say each time you're watering, you are fertilizing because you're watering over that fertilizer that then is leaching into the soil. So in terms of how much fertilizer we apply and the type of fertilizer we apply, it does depend on the stage of development of the tree. So if it's a young tree that's in early stages of development, say, for example, we're trying to really thicken the trunk on the plant, we might use a very high nitrogen synthetic or inorganic fertilizer. Whereas if we're working with an older, more refined tree, we might use an organic fertilizer that has a much lower nitrogen value. Nitrogen, as your listeners probably know, is essentially what produces elongating internodes, longer growth, and bigger leaves on your tree.
All about leaves, baby.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, our goal technically or typically is to produce as small a leaf as possible and maintain the growth on the plant without making it explode once it's an older, more refined, well-developed tree. So essentially, we're just in maintenance mode at that point. So using low nitrogen organic fertilizer is going to give you those type of results. So I've used, for example, here many different types of Japanese fertilizer, but also some stuff you can find in the States like Holytone. and plant tone. The problem with those two elements, though, is that if you put it directly on the soil surface, it will clog up the soil.
Mm.
Our bone size soil, the particle size, I should have mentioned this earlier, is actually about a 3/16 inch particle size. So it's actually quite large. The idea being that we want as much drainage as possible and as much aeration to the root system as possible. So if you put those products directly on the soil, it will leach in and clog up the soil. So typically what we do is put either of those products, the powder products, inside of tea bags and then set the tea bags on the soil. So each time you water, a little bit of it is leaching into the soil, or at least the nutrients are leaching in without the powder actually getting into the soil mix.
Oh my God, I have never heard of that before. What a cool idea.
Yeah, it's very tedious to fill them up. Luckily for me now, I have an apprentice here at the nursery, so I can make him do all of that stuff. But up until last year, I was doing all of that myself, or when my in-laws would visit from China, I had them help me put all that stuff together as well.
Okay. I'm getting the sense that bonsai is all about control on all elements, right? Like you're controlling the growth of the tree, the aesthetics of the tree, how it looks, but then also even within the fertilizer, you're tinkering with it depending on the growth stage and having more nitrogen to inspire more like foliage growth in the beginning to get the tree in the shape that you're in, the shape that you want. And then you're just managing the nutrients so the tree is going to thrive after you've kind of positioned it where it needs to be. Is that right?
Exactly. That's exactly what we're looking to do.
Okay. And once you get into that mature state, you're giving it more of just like a well-rounded, all the nutrients it needs, fertilizer, not more nitrogen forward.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, in the case of a plant that has gotten sick, for example, or weakened over time, which does happen, we might readjust the fertilization and perhaps apply a higher nitrogen at certain times during the growing season to boost the health of that plant. So it is dependent on not only the stage of development, but the individual health of that particular tree. And then again, the goals that we're shooting for, immediate and long-term. And in bonsai, our long-term goals, we're thinking anywhere from 5 to 25 years down the line with what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So it's a very long-term oriented hobby for sure.
Yeah. And watching your videos, that was something that I kept thinking about too, how you say things like, we're going to do this for now. Maybe next year we'll do this, or maybe in 2 years. And I'm like, wow, as the person who just wants that instant gratification of like the new Monstera leaf or like the new African violet blossom, like 4 times a year, it seems like bonsai requires a lot of patience. And then that's a beautiful, beautiful practice to integrate into your life, that practicing of patience, I think.
Absolutely. It definitely changes your perspective on a lot of things, not just working with plants, but for me, life in general. So I think now, you know, 25, 35 years down the line, how can I reach this particular goal in this aspect of my life? But all of that kind of comes from my experiences in bonsai with all of that delayed gratification.
Yeah. Oh my God. Amazing.
Thank you to Espoma Organics for sponsoring today's episode. Espoma is a family-owned and operated company dedicated to making safe indoor and outdoor gardening products for people, pets, and the planet. And now, plant friends, they have bonsai soil. I love that they have a high-quality organic potting mix for everything, no matter how you garden. So for indoors, they've got the all-purpose potting mix, the succulent potting mix, orchid mix, African violet mix, moisture retention mix. And then for outside, they have mixes specifically made for raised beds, for seed starting, for garden bed soil and garden amendments. And now they even have their high quality organic bonsai mix. I'm so excited to use it when I get my first bonsai under Bjorn's tutelage. The bonsai mix is made up of calcined clay and expanded shale, and it is specifically formulated for all bonsai to help improve moisture retention and aeration so the roots can grow and thrive. So to learn more all about all the potting mixes that Espoma has to offer, check out espoma.com to find your local Espoma dealer, or click the link in the show notes to go to my Amazon storefront for Espoma. Plant friends, I am so excited to introduce you to our newest sponsor and partner of Bloom and Grow Radio, Deer Busters. So if you have been struggling with deer or wildlife in your gardens in the growing season, you might want to consider a deer fence, which is the easiest way to humanely keep deer and wildlife to stop munching on your collard greens. You know what I'm saying? Deer Busters fencing kits are an awesome option. Oh my God, plant friends, when I moved to our current home on 5 acres in the middle of the woods, like this city girl had no idea of the struggles of trying to garden in a rural area with deer. And we're also in bear country. We've got all sorts of wildlife. Yes, these deer are adorable. You can tell on my Instagram, I'm stalking them. I'm obsessed with them, but I know that they can wreak havoc on our gardens. So I connected with a lot of new plant friends in the area through plant shops and nurseries, and everyone has pretty much said that you really have to have a deer fence if you want to garden in my neighborhood. And this really intimidated me. I'm not handy, and we're also renting, so we needed something that could have an easy install and an easy breakdown. And Deer Busters, I feel like, has been the answer to our prayers. They make fencing kits that are easy to install. They come with all the materials necessary to build a fence, and they're fully customizable by linear feet, corners, ends, gates, tensioning, rodent barriers, like whatever you need, they can basically make you a kit for it. And you don't need professional installation or fancy tools. If you might be interested in getting a deer and wildlife fence for you, they come in all sorts of materials. Visit deerbusters.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 10% off. So once again, that's 10% off with code BLOOM at checkout for deerbusters.com. Okay, back to Bjorn.
Do bonsai ever bloom? Do you want bonsai to bloom? Is that, now that we're talking about NPK, I'm thinking about P, which is all about blooming. Is that something you tinker with as well?
It is. It depends on the species, but as a general rule of thumb, when flowers are produced on a tree, it does sometimes weaken the plant. For example, developing an azalea, we may go 3 or 4 years without letting it bloom, meaning removing those flower buds before they totally pop open to help with the energy balance within the plant, mm-hmm. to get it really growing and thriving. And then in that 4th or 5th year, we might let it bloom. So it does depend on the species. Now, there are other species that we absolutely want to try to avoid forcing flowers on, like junipers, for example. They will flower, and that can really destroy the look of the plant and the foliage of the plant as well. And usually with flowering junipers, it's either a genetic propensity of that particular plant, or it's a stress reaction to some sort of outside influence or stimuli that's been applied to the plant. So for example, overly heavily bending a juniper or cutting off too much foliage, for example, or working the roots too much, all of those things can cause junipers to potentially flower, which is not a good thing. The plant essentially thinks that it's dying and that it needs to reproduce itself. So it produces those flowers in an attempt to propagate mm-hmm. itself again. And then it takes a number of years to get back to a much better foliage type on the plant. So that does happen on occasion.
Got it. Okay. So with this rockier or more aerated soil potting medium that you're potting them in, are you watering rather frequently? How frequently do you water normally?
Yeah, we definitely water much more frequently than you would with a full organic mix, like a potting mix, for example.
Yeah.
So here at my nursery, it depends on the season, but let's just start with like the spring season, for example. During that time of year, all of the plants, whether they're coniferous or deciduous material, they're all producing new growth, new top growth at that time of year. So they're sucking up a lot of water from the soil. So we're checking those trees typically 3 times a day in the spring.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty tedious and takes up a lot of our time, but spring is the most dangerous season for water with your bonsai. So we don't want them to wilt at all. We want them to stay mostly moist. Again, depending on the species, that might shift here and there. But we also know that we need to check each individual tree 3 times a day, but that doesn't mean we necessarily have to water each individual tree 3 times a day. So we're looking for the top layer of soil to have slightly dried out, and then we water the plant again. So you're looking for the soil, when it dries out, the roots start searching for more moisture within the soil system of the plant, within the pot. So they're producing more roots through that process. And then you quench those roots just at the right time. And then they produce more roots when it dries out again. So you get a lot of rapid root growth and top growth on the tree by doing that. When we get into the summer months, it's a little bit counterintuitive. It is getting hotter. Where we are, it's very humid. So during the summer months, we actually have to water a little bit less than we do in the spring. Mm-hmm. We still check mm-hmm. at least twice a day. Sometimes 3 times a day if it's just really, really hot and maybe windy, for example. And then when we move into the fall, we start watering less and less. So we'll check the water once a day, typically in the fall, and it may be 2 or 3 days between waterings of specific trees. If they're not drying out, we don't water them. In the winter, we still, again, check every day, but it could be a full week to 10 days between watering each individual plant. So my recommendation to most people who work and have a life and don't necessarily want to be checking their plants constantly is every morning before you go to work, just check your plant. If it's dry, go ahead and water it. When you come back in the evening, check it one more time. If it's still moist, leave it alone. If it's dry, go ahead and water it. And that keeps pretty much everybody on the right track for the most part. It sounds very daunting when I say you got to check 3 or 4 times a day, but as long as you stick with that basic schedule, morning and evening checking, you should be totally fine.
I have a plant parent personality test on my website that kind of profiles different personalities. One of them is the mindful plant parent, which is someone who likes to interact with their plants on a daily basis. And the test, you get a bunch of recommended plants, and I'm 100% adding bonsai, because I think with a lot of plant parents like us, we want to engage with our plants every day, but on a house plant level, your soil doesn't dry out that quickly. Like,
right.
You're lucky if you can water your plant once a week. And I would imagine bonsai indoors probably require less frequent watering than outdoor, just because they're not exposed to those elements. But wow, that's super interesting. I know that you don't have indoor bonsai, but do you have an idea for if we were to have an indoor like ficus, benjamina, or something, like what that frequency would look like in that bonsai soil?
In that particular bonsai mix, it is going to be somewhat relative to where you place the tree. For example,
of course,
it's next to a window and it's getting a lot more light, it's going to dry out more frequently. But as a general rule of thumb, I think you could probably get away with, I would still check every day, but I think you could probably get away with every 3 days to like once a week, for example, every 3 to 7 days, you should be fine.
Okay.
When you're dealing with something like a ficus retusa, for example, mm-hmm. or a narrow leaf ficus, for example, narrowfolia, those plants can go a little bit longer, I believe, between waterings. They will retain a lot of that within the trunk tissue. So you're looking at probably more like once a week, maybe even once every 10 days, depending on the season.
Okay. Wow. This is so fun. This is like mind-blowing. What about light? What's the light setup that's ideal for a bonsai?
Sure. If you're maintaining trees in your house, tropical plants are typically going to grow all year round. So I would recommend that you have some sort of lighting setup. Now, I'm no expert on that because, again, I don't grow indoor plants, mm-hmm. but I would definitely look into setting up some sort of lighting system to keep your plants growing during the entire year. In terms of working with temperate trees, for the most part, we want them to have as much light as possible. The more light you have, the smaller the leaf size is naturally going to become. The plant doesn't need to produce a massive leaf size to photosynthesize and produce food for itself. So the more light you have, the smaller the leaf size is, the softer the branch structure is going to be on the tree, and the easier in the long run it is to maintain that tree as a bonsai. That being said, there are certain species at certain times of year that I would recommend putting in partial shade. When you get to the hottest part of the summer, actually with most of your species, whether they be conifers or deciduous or broadleaf evergreen, I would recommend morning sun and afternoon shade. So if you have, you know, like a big oak tree in your backyard and you know an area that's going to get morning sun, but it gets shaded out by 2 in the afternoon or something, I would put the tree, your bonsai, in that location. The best case scenario would be to build a structure with like 30 to 40% shade cloth that's retractable, mm-hmm. but not everybody can do that. So we've actually built that here at my nursery. We've got two separate sections for shade cloth. One section has 40% and one section has 30%. So depending on the needs of the specific species, we'll put them under the different shade cloths.
Gotcha. That's next level, like day-to-day management of managing the shade and retractable cloth. Wow, that's wild. Okay, so that's a general light. Now we got to talk about pruning, because I feel like that's what bonsai is, right? You're pruning below the roots, you're pruning the tree. So can you kind of walk me through like bonsai pruning 101 for a beginner?
Sure. Yeah. So we'll start with the roots and then move to the shoots. So with the roots of the plants, again, everything in bonsai, there's so many variables to consider. So it does depend on each individual tree and the species as well. But as a general rule of thumb, what you're looking for is to repot your bonsai every typically 2 to 5 years. And what we're looking for is the water penetration. When you actually water the soil of the bonsai, if it's not penetrating into the soil anymore, if it's just pooling up on the surface, that either means that the soil is broken down so much that it's become compacted, or that tree is root bound. So it does need to be repotted. So we'll pop the trees out of the pots. We'll use root rakes, chopsticks, sometimes even leather punches, for example, to pick away at the soil, cut back the roots a little bit. And again, depending on the species, we can cut a lot of roots, or we have to be a little bit more careful. And then we'll repot the trees either in the same pot or perhaps up pot them into a bit larger pot, depending on the situation. So again, you know, every 2 to 5 years for that. With pruning the shoots on the trees, though, what I typically recommend for most species, and again, there are exceptions, but for most species, in the spring, the best thing to do is let all of your trees grow unimpeded. You don't want to be cutting back constantly in the spring. And the reason being is that in the spring, there's a hormonal exchange that's happening within the plants. So there's a growth hormone called auxin, A-U-X-I-N, that's in all of the shoots of all of your trees. It's in the shoot apical meristem, which is essentially the terminal shoots across the entire plant. So in the spring, if you're constantly pinching back that new growth right as it emerges, you're removing that auxin within that branch. If, however, you leave the shoots alone in the spring and let them elongate, that auxin is actually going to be transported down through the tissue of the tree to the root system of the tree. and interact with another hormone in the roots called cytokinin. That cytokinin is also being transported up to the shoots of the tree at the same time and producing better top growth. So this is something called crosstalk within the plant. So if you allow the shoots to grow in the spring without cutting them, you allow that crosstalk to happen, you're going to have better root growth and better subsequent top growth on your plants. Once that hormonal exchange has happened within the plant, typically in Tennessee, this would be early to mid-May, the growth has hardened off, meaning that the soft, fleshy new growth from the spring has turned into more of kind of a dark fluorescent color and kind of a waxy texture, for example. Then you can go through and prune back your trees. At that point, you're then going to activate side lateral branching within the plant. Mm-hmm. So in other words, whatever bud you cut back to in May, the next closest bud is going to activate and start growing at that point. So you get new growth in new directions within the tree. You get more branching within the plant as well. So you can produce more ramification, which again is that branch structure within the tree, number of branches. And then you can develop movement within the branch, ramification within the branch, tighter internodes, all of those things along with a healthier tree by treating it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're letting it grow wild through the spring and right as it tips into summer. For me, it's a little, in New York, it's a little farther.
Exactly.
I'm like, late May is our like last frost date. So as you tip into summer, wherever you are, whatever your hardiness zone is, that's when you can start pruning. And then that is going to instigate the lateral growth.
Exactly.
Love that. I think auxin, the concept, I did a whole podcast episode on like how poetic I think auxin is and how sometimes you have to prune back to inspire richer, lusher growth. And I don't know, I think pruning 2020 is a great example of pruning manifested. But anyway, I digress. Okay. So you're going to let it grow. You're going to prune it back. And then why the small pots? Is it just an aesthetic thing? Is that just bonsai aesthetic thing? That the pots are so small and the trees are so big?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
The idea is basically to make the tree appear as big as possible in as small a form as possible. So the larger the pot proportionally to the tree is going to feel smaller. So typically try to cram the trees in as small a pot as looks good and is sustainable for the tree. There are some exceptions to that though. So for example, if you're working with like a Japanese maple that has a big broad canopy and you're trying to design it as a tree that might be growing as a lone tree in a field. With those particular trees, if you put them in a very, very small pot, quite often it makes the tree feel constricted. Whereas if you put them in a much longer pot that's very, very shallow, it makes it feel much more open and broad and spreading. So there are some things like that to consider when you're choosing a pot for a tree. But as a general rule of thumb, the smaller the pot, the bigger the tree feels.
So when it's time for me to do my first root pruning, is there a general rule of thumb? Am I pretty much, if I want to keep it in the pot that the tree came in, I'm just snipping away enough to like get it back in the pot and not have it choke itself out? Is there like a general rule of thumb? I know, once again, it's all like tree specific. And when people get their first trees, they should all go look at your channel and find whatever, all the specific guidelines.
Sure. Yeah. I would recommend as a general rule of thumb, regardless of the species that you're working with, I would not prune back more than maximum 40% of the roots at any one go around. Ideally, you want to stick more in the 20 to 30% range. And really the goal is to remove a lot of the old soil within the root system of the tree, again, with a root rake or even better, a wooden chopstick and simply pick away at it. And just by doing that, you will inevitably remove some roots through that process. But removing that old soil exposed the outer periphery of the root system and the underside of the root system as well. And then you can prune that back a little bit. Again, 20 to 30% would be ideal for most situations. And then replenish the soil, put new soil in, really work it in between the roots, and the tree will thrive again in the spring if it's done properly. So one thing I would recommend that people don't do for the most part is take like a pressure washer or your hose and blast the soil out. Better to take your time, pick away at it. If you're really blasting that soil out with water, not only might you destroy some of the roots within the plant, but you're also removing a lot of the beneficial bacteria and fungi that are in the soil. And it becomes a little bit more difficult to replenish that when you repot the tree, because again, we're putting it in inert soil basically. So I would definitely recommend try avoiding blasting the root system if at all possible.
And it sounds like this whole process is all about mindfulness and intention. And why would we just go brutally with it with a hose on it? Repotting, does that happen in the summer as well? As you prune the top, you prune the bottom?
No. So we actually do the repotting in spring, typically for most species. Depending on the species, it could be late winter through late spring. It could be any time here in Nashville from say mid to late February all the way through mid-April. So there is quite a wide range there. But as a general rule of thumb, that's the best time of year to do it. You can also repot in the summer dormancy, which here typically happens in August. It's a little bit scary to do it at that time of year for most people. And there are only certain species I would recommend doing that time of year, like certain pines. But being dormant at that time of year, the growth shuts down. You can prune the roots a little bit, repot the tree. And then when it wakes back up in late summer, early fall, it's going to put out another flush of top growth and another flush of root growth as well. There are a couple of species that I would recommend repotting in the fall. Most of the plants in the rose family, so Chinese quince, Japanese quince, rose, of course, I would recommend repotting those in the fall because of root gall issues. Root gall will form over the summer and manifest in the fall. So if you repot in the fall, you can cut those root galls off so that the tree doesn't die over the course of the winter, waiting until spring to be repotted. So I would definitely recommend doing that. Root gall, they're basically these big knobs that start appearing on the root system of the tree.
Okay.
And essentially the only way to take care of them is to physically remove them from the plant. So yeah, you have to go through with scissors or specialty tools and cut those off. And then I'd recommend burning them as well.
Got it. So you mentioned a nice long planter, which is so cool. How does that work with the roots? So with that nice long planter, are you spreading the roots throughout the length of the planter and then potting the soil on top of it? Like you just kind of shape the roots amidst the planter, even though they're normally in like a root ball?
Yeah, exactly. So in early stages of development, to remove the tap root on the trees and then plant them in the soil and spread the roots out as much as possible. So depending on the style of tree, it will require a deeper or a shallower pot. What's interesting is the shallower the pot, the less of a water column that you're creating within the pot. So it actually dries out less, or it dries out less quickly than a deeper pot, which is a little bit counterintuitive. So if you're working with like a Japanese maple again, and you want to create that wide spreading base to the tree, you plant it in a shallow pot, but you may need to water it much less frequently than say a juniper in a pot that's 6 inches deep. That might require watering 3 or 4 times a day. And the Japanese maple might be every other day or every 3 days, for example.
Wow, that's super counterintuitive.
Yeah, it's all about gravity. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense when you think about it. Man, I'm getting really excited about what bonsai I'm going to get. Okay, so we covered light. You want them in light. You want them in 4 seasons, which is going to change light. You're watering, you're checking 1 to 2 times a day and watering when that topsoil just starts to dry out. You never let it, it sounds like you never let it dry out.
Exactly.
Then potting, we're using a bonsai specific inorganic soil. You're fertilizing a lot depending on the stage of where the tree is and altering the NPK because of that. So I think, and we covered basics of pruning. So that was the base pruning in the roots. So what about pruning in the shoots? Any like good practices?
Yeah. So again, in the spring, after you've let everything flush out and then it's time to prune back, as a general rule of thumb with most species, you're either going to find an opposite phylotaxy or an alternating phylotaxy, meaning the leaf pattern within the plant. So this would mean, for example, if you're looking at the shoot of like a hornbeam, it's going to be an alternating phylotaxy or an alternating leaf pattern. So the leaves and the buds are going to alternate down the length of that particular shoot. So typically by the time we get to late spring, early summer, if the tree is healthy, it will have put out a shoot that has anywhere from 6 to 10 leaves on it. As a general rule of thumb, what we're looking to do is cut back to 2 leaves with dormant buds at the base of those leaves. So essentially you want to look for those little bitty nubs that are right at the base of the leaves. And as long as you're counting at least 2, I would say 2 is pretty typical, pretty average. I would then cut back. There are a couple of considerations though. So whatever bud you cut back to, if it's on the left side of the shoot, for example, the next shoot is going to emerge moving towards the left. If you cut back to one on the right side of the shoot, the next shoot is going to emerge to the right. So if you're trying to grow a branch in a specific direction, it might be necessary to cut back to 3 buds instead of 2, or maybe even to 1 bud instead of 3. That will depend on the internode length as well within the plant. So we're always trying to look to push the growth back, create directionality, desirable in one direction or another within the plant. And then that's basically kind of clip and grow style of bonsai. So that would probably be the easiest way to approach it.
Okay. The thing that I've enjoyed the most about your YouTube channel is your time lapses of you styling, going from a raw, unstyled tree to a styled tree. And something that I noticed you're always doing is like wrapping string or wire and like doing all sorts of fancy bending of trees that I've never seen. So what is that called? And is that something that like a beginner bonsai person does? Or is that just like next level? Like, what is that?
Sure. Yeah. So in addition to pruning to get the desired shape out of the tree, we also use like copper or aluminum wire. And it depends on the species as to which one we'll use. So typically with conifers, we'll use copper wire, and it is annealed copper wire. So it's gone through a firing process, which makes it very soft. But when you apply it back to the tree, as you're moving it, it work hardens and it stiffens and stays in place. When we put copper wire on most conifers, it typically is going to stay on anywhere from 1 year to 5 years. So we're waiting for it to bite into the branch just a little bit before we remove it. If we're working with deciduous or broadleaf trees, like Japanese maple or hornbeam, for example, we'll use aluminum wire because the goal with those trees is to make sure that the wire never bites into the branch, which can happen anywhere from 2 months to 6 months after you apply it. So it's much faster. So we're looking to cut that off quite quickly. And aluminum wire is certainly much cheaper than copper wire. So from an economic perspective, it makes much more sense with our deciduous and broadleaf trees to apply aluminum wire to them.
And so is the wire only to shape the branches?
Yes, the wire is meant to shape the branches or to create pads, for example, those layers that you see within the tree, or to move a branch in a specific location to create a picture frame of foliage around an interesting characteristic on the plant. So if I'm working with a juniper, for example, and it has beautiful deadwood and a live vein, and there's just one particular portion of it that's super interesting, and I want your eye to go right to that point, I'll bring the foliage around and create those layers as a picture frame to draw your eye there.
Okay, right. And is there ever a moment, like, do you ever train a tree to be in a certain way and then you take the wire off, or does the wire stay on forever?
But the eventual goal after you've wired and unwired and rewired and unwired many, many times over decades, perhaps, is to get to a point where you can take the wire off. Most of the branches stay in the right spot, but you get this sort of natural kind of lift and softness to the tree. And it's this concept in Japanese called mochikomi, which directly translates to carried in. But what it means in regards to bonsai is a tree that has been worked over so many decades that when the wire is removed, it has a feeling of being correct, of being right, of feeling natural but refined, and having all of the parts in the right location without feeling plasticky and fake. And it's a very, very difficult aesthetic to achieve. Only a handful of trees really have what I would call true mochikomi.
Wow, that's so poetic. I'm so sold on this practice. I love that. Okay, what mistakes am I going to make? What are some common beginner mistakes that bonsai hopefuls commit?
Sure. I would say probably the biggest mistake that I see with beginners is buying too many plants too quickly. The issue is you want to experiment and try different species and make different styles, and you want to constantly be wiring different trees so you get the practice in. But if you do that, sometimes you end up with 100 trees in 3 months. And you're spending more time working on the stuff that won't necessarily become good, while the stuff that might have had really good potential gets put to the side and becomes worse and worse over time. So my recommendation would be to really think about the different species you want to work with. Maybe purchase one or two of each of those species. Maybe pick out five species and purchase two of each and experiment with them, wire them, prune them, see which ones you like. If you don't like any of them, set those aside, maybe sell them to a local club member if there's a bonsai club in your area, and then purchase another handful of trees and work on those. That's definitely the biggest mistake I see beginners make, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I could see that happening to me, because also with bonsai, if you're saying that I'm going to water it all year long, but I'm really only getting my hands in there in the spring turned summer.
Right.
That's a long wait for a little payoff, especially when I get my hands on it, maybe that year I'm only pruning a few little branches in order to kind of let it grow again next year. So that's really interesting. You're talking a lot about trees. So there's this amazing nursery in the town that I just moved to, and they have a whole bonsai section. And when I go over there, I feel so intimidated because the bonsais have like some name tags in them, but some of them don't. And I don't know where to start. I don't know what to pick. So what would your advice be for like buying your first bonsai tree?
I think probably the standard one that I would recommend that you can find the easiest would be Juniperus procumbens, or the green mound juniper, Japanese green mound juniper. They're more of a bush. They're laterally oriented, so you don't have to constantly be pruning the apex of the tree back. They grow relatively slowly as well, but they are a temperate tree, so it would be a plant that would need to be kept outdoors. As a matter of fact, the first bonsai that I got was a green mound juniper. And like I said, I kept it on my nightstand and it died within a couple of weeks.
Right, in no light, probably.
Exactly,
right,
yeah. Like, so you definitely want to keep something like that outside. If you are wanting to work with a deciduous tree, for example, I would recommend Japanese maple. Again, they do need to stay outside, but they are relatively slow growing. And the pruning process with those, really, it just requires one or two prunings a year. So if you're overwhelmed by the thought of having to constantly pinch back or prune a different species, I think Japanese maple would be probably your best bet with deciduous material, and they're beautiful bonsai as well. If you're wanting to do an indoor or tropical tree, any of those ficus species would definitely be the best for sure. They're pretty forgiving, although when you do move them from one location to another, they might drop their leaves, but that's just a natural process with those species. They will flush out again. So Ficus benjamina, retusa, or nerifolia, any of those I would recommend.
Okay. I have a little desk lamp that I just swapped a grow light into on my desk. And my thought for my first bonsai is that I'm going to put it under the desk lamp so it gets enough light. So maybe you and I can stay in touch and I'll report back and let you know if I kill it or not.
Sure, that sounds perfect.
I'll be your like guinea pig. I'll be your spy or your researcher for indoor bonsai.
Perfect.
Oh, here's a question about different types of trees. I'm obsessed with hinoki scent. So I diffuse it every day at my desk. I'm like totally entranced by it. Is that a good starter tree? I've watched several of your hinoki videos.
Yeah, hinoki cypress is one of my favorite species to work with. And it actually would be a good beginner tree as well. They're quite slow growing. They're very easy to prune. The only thing that might be a little scary for a beginner is that in the summer and again in the fall, particularly in the fall, they will shed internal growth. So it'll turn essentially a brownish or yellowish color and fall off. So you're basically left with a kind of an outer shell of foliage. And this is just a natural process with the trees looking to avoid overtranspiration. So they'll throw off unnecessary foliage, and typically that's internal foliage. So with bonsai, our goal is to keep the trees small. So we want to keep that internal foliage alive. So in pruning in the summer and again in early fall, you can help offset that internal shedding. So pruning back the outer canopy a little bit will help keep that internal growth alive. But aside from that, they're very easy to maintain. They do require a little bit more water than a lot of other conifers. So you might have to water them slightly more frequently. But other than that, yeah, it's definitely a good beginner type tree to work with for sure.
Can you get them in the Shohin miniature size, or are they more of a medium-sized plant?
You can find like dwarf cultivars, for example, that make great Shohin size bonsai. So there's one in particular called Seka Hinoki. It's spelled S-E-K-K-A. It's actually surprisingly relatively fast growing for a dwarf, but the foliage is super tight, very, very compact. And again, you will have to prune them, you know, once in the summer and once again in late summer, early fall, for example, and they will shed a little bit, but they make really nice Shohin bonsai. So on our YouTube channel last summer, I did a video on styling Seka Hinoki. So if anybody wants to check that out, they can definitely do that.
Oh, we'll link to it in the show notes. Also, where do you recommend buying bonsai?
That is a very good question. So
your nursery in Nashville, but if we don't live in Nashville.
Sure. Yeah. One of the best online outlets, I would say, would be a friend of mine named Brussels Martin. He owns a nursery called Brussels Bonsai, spelled like the city in Belgium. But he lives in, or the nursery is in Olive Branch, Mississippi, and it's the largest bonsai nursery in the entire US. As a matter of fact, most of the bonsai that you're going to see at like Lowe's and Home Depot or on flowers.com, for example, are made at this nursery and then shipped out to these different locations. But you can buy directly from bonsai, Brussels Bonsai on his website. So it's brusselsbonsai.com. Yeah, and they've got everything from indoor trees to outdoor trees, beginner stuff to much more advanced plants as well.
Oh, amazing. Okay, we'll definitely link to that. And that's maybe, hopefully he has a second tree that I can order from him.
He will absolutely have them.
Oh, cool. And do they have that beautiful smell?
They do, yeah. They definitely smell like a typical chamoecyparis.
Oh, so good. Okay. Amy, one of our Patreon supporters, wanted to know any quick winterizing tips.
Sure, yeah. So as a general rule of thumb, I recommend if you can keep your bonsai, your temperate bonsai, at around freezing temperatures or slightly above, that's the ideal situation. So 35 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit consistently in like a cold frame or a greenhouse, that would be great. Most people aren't able to do that though. So at the very least, I would recommend putting your bonsai on the ground so that you get some of that geothermal heat for the root system of the plant. If it's going to get very cold, say below 18 or 20 degrees Fahrenheit, I would recommend moving most of your bonsai into like an unheated garage or a basement, or even just inside the house for a night or two until those temperatures pass. So for example, here in Nashville for the last couple of days, it's been, I think the lowest we got was 10 degrees.
Yeah, which is psycho.
Ridiculous. Yeah, it's crazy. So we put most of our trees in the cold frame, a few things on the ground, and then the more expensive trees we actually put inside of the workshop just for added safety. You know, some of the plants that we have here are very, very expensive, and a lot of them are client trees as well. So they're expecting us to provide the best possible care for them. So we did move those inside the workshop.
Don't you have one of the first bonsais you ever worked on in Japan in your shop now?
I do. It actually just left my shop and got shipped across country to another private collection. But in my third year as an apprentice in Japan, I worked on a juniper. One of our customers from the States saw that tree and decided to legally import it to the United States, which is a very difficult process. But the tree survived, and then he decided to sell it a few years later. So I had it in my nursery for, I guess, about 6 months or so. And then just last week, it got shipped off to the other side of the US to a private collection.
Wow. Very cool. That's amazing. One other question, pest control. Anything to know about pest control with bonsai if your bonsai gets a little pest infestation?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend spraying preventively rather than reactively. So we use a whole host of different pesticides and fungicides here. But as a general rule of thumb, I would say in terms of stuff that you can find off the shelf, I would recommend malathion, which you can get from Lowe's and Home Depot. It's for basically all your pests. It'll kill essentially everything. You do need to be extra careful with it. If you are going to spray, make sure you're wearing a mask because you can get malathion poisoning. So definitely be careful with that. For fungicides, I would recommend something like Cleary's 3336, which is a systemic. You can get it in granular form or in spray form. I typically use a spray form. If you don't want to use spray fungicides and pesticides, I would recommend granular imidacloprid by Merit, M-E-R-I-T. That's good for borers, for all sorts of insects in the springtime, and it'll take care of your trees for most of the growing season. And then for fungicides, in terms of granular, I would recommend something called Infuse, which of course you can also get at Home Depot and Lowe's too.
And those things you're using routinely to avoid a pest outbreak.
Exactly.
Or a fungus outbreak.
Exactly. Okay. We usually spray or apply some form of granular essentially once a month here, because again, you know, a lot of our trees are very expensive and I don't want any issues with the plants at all. I will say with imidacloprid, for example, it does kill bees. So if you do have a bee population in your area, I wouldn't recommend using it. Or if you are going to use it, only use the granular form and not the spray form, just for safety's sake. But anything else, I think you should be fine. Malathion, it's not going to kill bees. So you're totally fine using something like that.
Awesome. One final question. Thanks for your patience with letting me grill you for the last hour. Why should everyone try bonsai if they're normal houseplant collectors?
I think it is one of the most engaging and interesting hobbies you can get into. And it really shifts your perspective on sort of long-term orientation and instant gratification. It's one of those things that will definitely make you think differently about not only plants, but life in general. So I think it's definitely an interesting hobby for anybody, anywhere, at any time.
I love that. And we have barely scratched the surface of bonsai, how to create it, especially now that I've watched your YouTube channel. I'm like, oh my God, I could ask you questions for 4 more hours. So where can everyone find you and where can they learn from you even on a deeper level?
Sure. Yeah. So of course we do have our YouTube channel. If you just search my name or ASEIEN, which is our nursery here, it's E-I-S-E-I-E-N. All of our videos on YouTube will pop up. And then on my website, we have our Bonsai U membership platform. So you can go to bjornbjornholm.com and sign up for that. So we put out new demonstrations every month, several demonstrations, as a matter of fact. And then I also do live Q&As with all of our members. And we have a member forum too. So people can bounce ideas off each other, share photos, maintenance tips, things like that. But the videos on our Bonsai U membership platform are much more in-depth than what you'll find on YouTube as well. So if anybody wants to sign up for that, definitely check that out.
If you want to go deep, oh, I love it. I'm really excited to check that out and check out all your content. And I will be your indoor bonsai novice learner and keep you posted. Also, if you guys want to check it out, Bjorn was kind enough to actually make a YouTube video that's going to be on Bloom and Grow's channel all about the best beginner bonsai. And he's actually going to show us a few of the best beginner specimens. So definitely go check it out. In addition to checking out everything Bjorn has to offer, they're all going to be in the show notes. Holy moly, Bjorn, thank you so much for this conversation. And I hope that maybe I could convince you in 6 months or a year after everybody's gotten their beginner plant, maybe we could have you back on for kind of a 2.0 episode.
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bjorn. I just loved this conversation. It showed my hand at how little I know about bonsai, but it was a really fun intro. Bjorn is so knowledgeable. If you haven't already, check his YouTube out. It's really the most relaxing thing to watch. He's so knowledgeable and gives so much information, but he also has these like kind of time-lapse videos that are just so soothing to watch, and his creations are so amazing. So check him out. All of his links are in the show notes. Thank you again to our new Patreon plant friends. I am so excited. Plant friends, I've been working really hard behind the scenes with Vivian, another member of this community, to launch a community on like extra strength fertilizer with really fun perks. And I can't wait to tell you more about it. We're currently beta testing it with some ride or die listeners and building it to be the best that it can be. And I just can't wait to tell you more. So keep your eyes peeled to an extra bonus episode in the next couple of weeks, which is going to be all about it. I hope that those of you in an area where it is becoming spring, I hope you are enjoying the warmth of the soil and it is in turn warming your souls the way it's warming mine. I truly feel like a seed that has just been like waiting for the sun and the warmth to come out to germinate and grow. So I'm very excited. I'm seeing plant life parallels everywhere as per usual. And until next time, I hope you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section and leave us a review? It would be tremendously helpful for the show, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more planty content or ways to help and support the show or engage with our community, we've got a ton of options for you. So first, there's the free Bloom and Grow Plant Parent Personality Test. It is a super fun 3-minute test that I made for you that pairs you with your plant parent personality profile, where you'll learn your planty strengths and weaknesses and get a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you. The test lives at bloomandgrowradio.com/personality, and you have to let me know what your results are on Instagram. You can find me on Instagram at Bloom and Grow Radio. If you're interested in supporting Bloom and Grow Radio, consider becoming a Patreon plant friend of the show. Patreon plant friends are members of the community who support the show monetarily on a monthly basis for as little as $4 a month, and these magical humans help support the show and bring our content to as many planty eyes and ears as possible. Once you join, you'll also get the secret password to our Facebook group, which I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. We have a lot of fun over there. You can become a Patreon plant friend at patreon.com/bloomandgrowradio. And of course, you can also just join our newsletter that I like to call the Garden Club. When you join our Garden Club, you'll receive a free download of the exclusive Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print, which is so adorable. And I'll slide into your inboxes, usually only around twice a month, with plant care tips, recent episodes, and announcements. You can join at bloomandgrowradio.com/community. And for anything else, plant friends, I'm here for you. So feel free to drop me a line when you have an idea for an episode, an event, or maybe even if you're a planty business interested in sponsoring the show. Thanks again for listening. It is my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will will pop up. So you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test. Because, plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right house plants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.